out. Using storms to kill those people is insanely dangerous, but you are just the sort of ambitious fool who would do it. He set his jaw in a hard line. Have a seat, he said, gesturing at a table. The people sitting at it cleared away, fast. We're going to stay here, both of us, and I'm going to make sure you don't have the chance to use the storm to hurt anyone else. I'm going to make sure you don't try your cowardly tricks until the council decides your fate. His gray eyes glittered with grim determination and certainty. I stared at him. I swallowed my anger, the words I wanted to throw back at him, the spell I wanted to blast him out of my way with, and spoke gently. Morgan, I know who the killer is, and he's after me next. If I don't get to him and stop him, I'm as good as dead. His eyes hardened, a fanatic's gleam. He spoke in two sharp little explosions of single syllables. Sit down! He drew the sword out from its scabbard by a couple of inches. I let my shoulders sag. I turned toward the table. I leaned against the back of one of the chairs for a moment, taking a little weight off my injured leg, and drew the chair out from the table. Then I picked it up, spun in a half circle with it to gather momentum, and smashed it into the warden's stomach. Morgan tried to recoil, but I caught him off guard, and the blow struck home, hard and heavy with the weight of Mac's handmade wooden chair. In real life, the chair doesn't break when you slug somebody with it, like in the movies. The person you hit is the one who breaks. Morgan doubled forward, dropping to one hand and one knee. I didn't wait for him to recover. Instead, as the chair bounced off his ribs, I used the momentum of it to spin all the way around in a complete circle in the other direction, lifting the chair high, and brought it smiting down over the other man's back. The blow drove him hard into the floor, where he lay, unmoving. I sat the chair back at the table and looked around the room. Everyone was staring, pale. They knew who Morgan was, what his relationship to me was. They knew about the council and my precarious stance with it. They knew that I had just assaulted a duly appointed representative of the council in pursuit of the execution of his duty. I'd rolled the stone over my own grave. There wasn't a prayer I could convince the council. I wasn't a rogue wizard fleeing justice now. Hell with him, I said out loud, to no one in particular. I haven't got time for this. Mac came out from behind the bar, not moving in a hurry, but not with his usual laconic lack of concern either. He knelt by Morgan and felt his throat, and peeled back an eyelid and peered at the man. Mac squinted up at me and said, expressionless, alive. I nodded, feeling some slight relief. However much of an ass Morgan was, he had good intentions. He and I wanted the same thing, really. He just didn't recognize that. I didn't want to kill him. But I had to admit, in some gleeful little corner of my soul, that the look of shocked surprise on his arrogant face as I hit him with a chair was a sight worth remembering. Matt stopped and picked up the keys where I dropped them on the floor as I swung the chair. I hadn't noticed that I had. Mac handed them back to me and said, "Council will be pissed." "Let me worry about that." He nodded. "Luck, Harry." Mac offered me his hand, and I took it. The room was silent, fearful, worried eyes watching me. I took the keys and walked up, out of the light and shelter of McAnally's, into the storm, my bridges burning behind me.
Please insert the next CD to continue the story.
I drove for my life. Mac's car was an 89 Trans Am, pure white, with a big 8-cylinder engine. The speedometer goes to 130 miles an hour. In places, I went that fast. The falling rain made the roads dangerous at that speed I was driving, but I had plenty of incentive to keep the car moving as quickly as possible. I was still riding the steel hard edge of anger that had carried me away from the ruins of my office and through Morgan. The sky grew darker, a combination of building banks of storm clouds in the approaching dusk. The lighting was strange, greenish, and the leaves of the trees, as I left the city, were standing out too sharply, too harshly. The yellow of the lines in the road too dim. Most of the cars I saw had their headlights on, and streetlights were clicking a light as I barreled down the highway. Fortunately, Sunday evening isn't a busy one as far as traffic goes. I'd have been dead any other night. I must also have been driving during the watch rotation for the highway patrol, because not one of them tried to pull me over. I tried to tune in the weather station on the radio, but gave it up. The storm, plus my own agitation, was creating a cloud of squealing feedback on the radio speakers, but nothing intelligent about the storm. I could only pray that I was going to get over to Lake Providence before it did. I won. The curtains of rain parted for me as I whipped past the city limit signs for Lake Providence. I hit the brakes to slow for the turn onto the lakefront road that led to the Sells house, started hydroplaning, turned to the slide with more composure and ability than I really should have had, and got the vehicle back under control in time to slide onto the correct road. I pulled into the Sells gravel driveway on the swampy little peninsula that stretched out into Lake Michigan. The Trans Am slid to a halt in a shower of gravel and a roar of the mighty engine, then sputtered and gasped to silence. I felt for a giddy second and a half like Magnum. Blue Beetle aside, I could get into this sports car thing. At least it's lasted long enough for me to get to the Sells place. Thanks, Mac, I grunted and got out of the car. The gravel driveway leading back to the lake house was half sunken in water from the recent storms. My leg hurt me too much to run very fast, but I set off down the drive at a long-legged lope, rapidly eating the distance to the house. The storm loomed before me, rolling across the lake toward the shore. I could see columns of rain, dimly lit by the fading light, falling into its waters. I raced the storm to the house. As I did, I drew every bit of power and alertness that I could, keyed myself to a tighter level, tuned my senses to their sharpest pitch. I came to a halt 20 yards shy of the house and closed my eyes, panting. There could be magical traps or alarms strewn about, or spiritual or shrouded guardians invisible to the naked eye. There could be spells waiting, illusions meant to hide Victor Sells from anyone who came looking. I needed to be able to see past all that. I needed to have the edge of every scrap of knowledge I could get. So I opened my third eye. How can I explain what a wizard sees? It isn't something that lends itself readily to description. Describing something helps to define it, to give it limits, to set guardrails of understanding around it. Wizards have the sight since time began, and they still don't understand how it works, why it does what it does. The only thing that I can say is that I felt as though a veil of thick cloth had been lifted from me as I opened my eyes again. And not only from my eyes, but from all of my senses. I could abruptly smell the mud and the fish odor of the lake, the trees around the house, the fresh scent of the coming rain preceding the storm on the smoke-stained wind. I looked at the trees, saw them, not just the first green coat of spring, but in the full bloom of summer, the splendor of the fall and the barren desolation of winter all at the same time. I saw the house, each separate part of it with its own component, the timbers as parts of spectral trees, the windows as pieces of distantly sandy shores. I could feel the heat of summer and the cold of winter in the wind coming off the lake. I saw the house wreathed in ghostly flames and knew that those were in at least part of its future, that fire lay down several of the many paths of possibility that lay ahead in the next hour. The house itself was a place of power. Dark emotions, greed, lust, hatred, all hung over its visible things, molds and slimes that were strewn over it like Spanish moths with malevolent eyes. Ghostly things, restless spirits, moved around the place, drawn to the sense of fear, despair, and anger that hung over it. Mindless shades that were always to be found in such places, like rats in granaries. The other thing I saw over the house was a grinning, empty skull. Skulls were everywhere. Wherever I looked, just at the edge of my vision, silent and still and bleach white, as solid and real as though a fetishist had scattered them around in anticipation of some bizarre holiday. Death. Death lay in the house's future. Tangible, solid, unavoidable. Maybe mine. I shuddered and shoved the feeling away. No matter how strong the vision, how powerful the image gained with the sight, the future is always mutable, always something that could be changed. No one had to die tonight. It didn't have to come to that, not for them and not for me. But a sick feeling had settled into me as I looked on this darkling house with all of its stinking lust and fear, all of its horrid hate worn openly upon it to my sight, like a mantle of flayed human skin on the shoulders of a pretty girl with gorgeous hair, luscious lips, sunken eyes, and rotting teeth. It repulsed me, and it made me afraid. And something about it, intangible, something I couldn't name, called to me, beckoned. Here was power. Power I had thrust aside once before, in the past. I had thrown away the only family I'd ever known to turn away power exactly like this. This was the sort of strength that could reach out and change the world to my will, bend it and shape it to my desiring, could cut through all the petty trivialities of law and civilization and impose order where there was none, guarantee my security, my position, my future. And what had been my reward for turning that power aside thus far? Suspicion and contempt from the very wizards I had acted to support and protect. Condemnation from the White Council, whose laws I had clung to when all the world had been laid at my feet. I could kill the Shadow Man, now, before he knew I was here. I could call down fury and flame on the house and kill everyone in it, not leave one stone upon another. I could reach out and embrace the dark energy he had gathered in this place, draw it in and use it for whatever I wanted, and the consequences be damned. Why not kill him now? Violet light, visible to my sight, throbbed and pulsed inside the windows, power being gathered and prepared and shaped. The Shadow Man was inside, and he was gathering his might, preparing to unleash the spell that would kill me. What reason had I to let him go on breathing? I clenched my fists in fury, and I could feel the air crackle with tension as I prepared to destroy the lake house, the Shadow Man, and any of the pathetic underlings he had with him. With such power, I could cast my defiance at the council itself, the gathering of white-bearded old fools without foresight, without imagination, without vision. The council and that pathetic watchdog Morgan had no idea of the true depths of my strength. The energy was all there, gleeful within my anger, ready to reach out and reduce to ashes all that I hated and feared. A silver pentacle that had been my mother's burned cold on my chest, a sudden weight that made me gasp. I sagged forward a little and lifted my hand. My fingers were so tightly crushed into fists that it hurt to try to open them. My hand shook, wavering, and began to fall again. Then something strange happened. Another hand took mine. The hand was slim, the fingers long and delicate, feminine. The hand gently covered mine and lifted it, like a small child's, until I held my mother's pentacle in my grasp. I held it in my hand, felt its cool strength, its ordered and rational geometry. The five-pointed star within the circle was the ancient sign of white wizardry, the only remembrance of my mother. The cold strength of the pentacle gave me a chance, and a moment to think again, to clear my head. I took deep breaths, struggling to see clear of the anger and hate and the deep lust that burned within me for vengeance and retribution. That wasn't what magic was for. That wasn't what magic did. Magic came from life itself, from the interaction of nature and the elements, from the energy of all living things, and especially of people. A man's magic demonstrates what sort of person he is, what is held most deeply inside of him. There is no truer gauge of a man's character in the way he employs his strength, his power. I was not a murderer. I was not like Victor Sells. I was Harry Blackstone Copperfield Dresden. I was a wizard. Wizards control their power. They don't let it control them. And wizards don't use magic to kill people. They use it to discover, to protect, to mend, to help, not to destroy. The anger abruptly evaporated. The burning hate subsided, leaving my head clear enough to think again. The pain in my leg settled into a dull ache, and I shivered in the wind and the first droplets of rain, miserable. I didn't have my staff, and I didn't have my rod. The trinkets I did have with me were either expended or burned to uselessness. All I had was what was inside of me. I looked up, suddenly feeling smaller and very alone. There was no one near me, no hand touching mine. No one stood close by. For just a moment I thought I smelled a whiff of perfume, familiar and haunting. Then it was gone. And the only one I had to help me was myself. I drew out a breath. Well, Harry, I told myself, that's just going to have to be enough. And so I walked through the spectral landscape littered with skulls into the teeth of the coming storm, to a house covered in malevolent power, throbbing with savage and feral mystic strength. I walked forward to face a murderous opponent who had all the advantages, who stood prepared and willing to kill me from where he stood within the heart of his own destructive power, while I was armed with nothing more than my own skill and wit and experience. Do I have a great job or what? The sight of Victor's lake house will always be with me. It was an abomination. It looked innocuous enough, physically, but on a deeper level, it was foul, rotten. It seethed with negative energy, anger and pride and lust, especially lust. Lust for wealth, lust for power, more than physical desire. Shadowy spirit beings that weren't wholly real, only manifestations of the negative energy of the place, clung to the walls, the rain gutters, the porch, the windowsills, glutting themselves on the negative energy left over from Victor's spellcasting. I was guessing that there was a lot of it. He didn't strike me as someone who would be able to make sure his spells were energy efficient. I limped up the front steps. My sight revealed no alarms, no sorcerous tripwires. I might be giving Victor Shadowman too much credit. He was as powerful as a full-blown wizard, but he didn't have the education. Muscles, not brains, that was Victor Shadowman. I had to keep that in mind. I tried the front door, just for the hell of it. It opened. I blinked, but I didn't question the good fortune or the overconfidence that had seen to it that Victor left his front door standing unlocked. Instead, I took a breath, gathered up what will I had, and pressed inside. I forget how the house was furnished or decorated. All I remember is what the sight showed me. More of the same as the outside, but more concentrated, more noxious. Things clung everywhere. Things with silent, glittering eyes and hungry expressions. Some reptilian, some more like rats, some insectoid. All of them were unpleasant, hostile, and shied away from me as I came in, as the aura of energy I held in readiness around me touched them. They made quiet noises, things I would never have heard with my ears. But the sight encompasses all of that. There was a long, dark hallway coated with the things. I advanced slowly, quietly, and they oozed and crept and slithered from my path. The dark purple light of magic that I had seen from the outside was ahead of me and growing brighter. I could hear music playing and recognized it as the same music that had been playing on the CD player at the Madison in Tommy Tom's suite when Murphy had asked me there on Thursday. Slow, sensuous music, steady rhythm. I closed my eyes for a moment, listening. I heard sounds. The quiet whisper being repeated over and over. A man's voice repeating an incantation, holding a spell for readiness for release. That would be Victor. I heard soft sighs of pleasure from a woman. The Becketts, I could only assume so. And in a rumble that I could feel through the soles of my boots, I heard thunder over the lake. The low, chanting voice took on an edge of vicious, spiteful satisfaction and continued incantation. I gathered up what energy I had and stepped around the corner, out of the hallway, into the spacious room that stretched up to the full height of the house without interruption, yards of open air. The room below was a living room. A spiral staircase wound its way up to what looked like a kitchen and dining room on a sort of platform or balcony above the rest of the room. The elevated deck of the back of the house must have been accessible from the platform. There was no one in the main room. The chanting and the occasional sigh came from the platform above. The CD player was down in the room beneath, music flowing from speakers that were covered with an image of fire and dozens of bloated, disgusting creature forms, feeding on the music as it came out. I could see the influence of the music as a faint, violet mist in tune with the light coming from the platform above. This was a complex ritual spell, then, involving many base elements coordinated by a central wizard, Victor. Tricky. No wonder it was so effective. It must have taken Victor a lot of trial and error to figure it out. I glanced up at the platform, then crossed the room keeping as far away as I could from the CD player. I slipped under the platform without making any noise, and dozens upon dozens of slimy, non-physical spirit things oozed from my path. Rain increased to a dull, steady rhythm outside, on the roof and on the wooden deck and against the windows. There were boxes stacked all around me, plastic cases and cartons and cardboard boxes and wooden crates. I opened the nearest one and saw inside at least 100 slender vials like the ones I'd seen before, full of the liquid three-eye. Beneath the vision of my sight, it looked different, thick and cloudy with possibility, potential disaster lurking in every vial. Faces twisted in horror and torment swam through the liquid, ghostly images of what might be. I looked in the other boxes. In one, ancient liquor bottles, full of an almost luminescent green liquid. Absinthe? I leaned closer, sniffing, and could almost taste the madness that swam latent in the liquid. I leaned back from the boxes, stomach churning. I checked the other boxes quickly. Ammonia, reminiscent of hospitals and mental wards. Peyote mushrooms and plastic Tupperware, I was familiar with them. Alum, white and powdery. Antifreeze, glitter in 100 metallic shades in a huge plastic bag. Other things, deeper in the shadows that I didn't take time to look at. I had already figured out what all the articles were for. Potions. Ingredients for potions. This is how Victor was making the three-eye. He was doing the same thing I did when I made my little potions, but on a grander scale. Using energy he stole from other places, other people. He used absinthe as a base and moved out from there. Victor was mass-producing what amounted to a magical poison, one that probably remained inert until it was inside Simlin, interacting with their emotions and desires. That would explain why I hadn't noticed anything about it before. It wouldn't have been obvious to a cursory examination, or to anything short of fully opening up my sight. And that wasn't something I did very often. I closed my eyes, shaking. The sight was showing me too much. That was always the problem with it. I could look at these ingredients, the cases of the finished drug, and catch flash images of exactly how much suffering could be caused. There was too much. I was starting to get disoriented. Thunder came again, more sharply, and above me. Victor's voice rose in pitch to something audible. He was chanting in an ancient language, an Egyptian, Babylonian. It didn't really matter. I could understand the sense of the words clearly enough. They were words of hate, malevolence. They were words that were meant to kill. My shaking was becoming more pronounced. Was it only the effects of the sight? The presence of so much negative energy reacting with me? No. I was simply afraid. Terrified to come out of my hiding place under the platform and meet the master of the slithering horde that was draped all over everything in sight. I could feel his strength from here, his confidence, the force of his will infusing the very air with a sort of hateful certainty. I was afraid with the same fear that a child feels when confronted with a very large, angry dog, or with a neighborhood bully, the kind of fear that paralyzes, makes you want to make excuses and hide. But this was no time for hiding, no time for excuses. I had to act. So I forced my sight closed and gathered my courage as best I could. Thunder roared outside, and there was a flash of lightning, the two happening close together. The lights flickered, and the music skipped a track. Victor screamed out the incantation in a kind of ecstasy above me. The woman's voice, presumably Mrs. Beckett's, rose to a fevered pitch. "He pays your money and he takes your chances," I muttered to myself. I forced my will, extended my right arm and open palm to the stereo equipment, and shouted, "Fuego!" A rush of heat from my hand exploded into flame from the far side of the room and engulfed the stereo, which began to emit a sound more like a long, tortured scream than music. Murphy's handcuffs still dangling from my wrist, one loop swinging free. Then I turned, extended my arms, and roared, "Venice!" Wind swept beneath me, making my duster billow like Batman's cloak, lifting me directly up to the platform above and over its low railing, into the suspended room. Even expecting the sight, it rattled me. Victor was dressed in black slacks, a black shirt, black shoes. Very stylish, especially compared to my sweaty pants and cowboy boots. His shaggy eyebrows and lean features were highlighted eerily in the dark light, following up from the circle around him, where the implements of his ritual spell were ready to complete the ceremony that would kill me. He had what looked like a spoon, its edges sharpened to razor keenness, a pair of candles, black and white, and a white rabbit, its feet bound with red cord. One of its legs was bleeding from a small tear, staining the white fur, and tied against his head with the cord was a lock of my own dark, straight hair. Over to one side was another circle, laid out in chalk above the carpeting, maybe 15 feet across. The Becketts were inside, wreathing together in madness, sweating desire, generating energy for Victor's spell. Victor stared at me in shock as I landed upon the balcony, wind whipping around me, roaring inside the small room like a miniature cyclone, knocking over potted plants and knickknacks. "You!" he shouted. "Me," I confirmed. "There's something I've been meaning to talk to you about, Vic." His shock transformed into snarling anger in a heartbeat. He snatched up the sharpened spoon, raised it in his right hand, and screamed out words of the incantation. He dragged the rabbit in front of him, the ceremonial representation of me, and prepared to gouge out its, and therefore my, heart. I didn't give him the chance to finish it. I reached into a pocket and hurled the empty plastic film canister at Victor Shadowman. As a weapon, it wasn't much, but it was real. It had been hurled by a real person, a mortal. It could shatter the integrity of a magic circle. The canister went through the air above Victor's circle and broke it, just as he completed the incantation and drove the spoon blade down at the poor rabbit. The energy of the storm came whipping down the cylinder of focus created by Victor's now flawed circle. Power shattered out into the room, wild, undirected, and unfocused, naked color and raw sound spewing everywhere with hurricane force. It sent objects flying, including Victor and me, and shattered the secondary circle the Becketts were in, sending them rolling and bumping across the floor and into one wall. I braced myself against the guardrail and held on as the power raged around me, charging the air with raw, dangerous magic, surging about like water under pressure, seeking an outlet. "You bastard!" Victor screamed into the gale. "Why don't you just die?" He lifted a hand and screamed something at me, and fire washed across the place between us, instant and hot. I tapped some of the ample power now available in the room and formed a hard, high wall in front of me, squeezing my eyes shut to aid in concentration. It was a dozen times harder to shield without my bracelet, but I blocked the flame. Sent it swirling high and over me, huddled over the little quarter dome of hardened air that would not let Victor's magic past it. I opened my eyes in time to see the flames touch the ceiling beams and set them alight. The air was still thrummed with energy as the wash of flame passed. Victor snarled when he saw me rise, lifted a hand to one side, and snarled out words of summoning. A crooked stick that looked like it might have been some kind of bone soared through the air toward him, and he caught it in one hand, turning to me with the attitude of a man holding a gun. The problem with most wizards is they get too used to thinking in terms of one venue, magic. I don't think Victor expected me to rise, lurch across the trembling floor towards him, and drive my shoulder into his chest, slamming him back into the wall with a satisfying thud. I leaned back a little and drove my knee toward his gut, missed, and got him square between the legs instead. The breath went out of him in a rush, and he doubled over to the ground. By this time I was screaming at him, senseless and incoherent. I started kicking at his head. I heard a metallic, ratcheting sound behind me and spun my head in time to see Becket, naked, point an automatic weapon at me. I drew myself to one side and heard a brief explosion of gunfire. Something hot tore at my hip, spinning me into a roll, and I kept going into the kitchen. I heard Becket snarl a curse. There was a number of sharp clicking sounds the automatic had jammed. Hell, with this much magic flying around the room, we were all lucky the thing hadn't just exploded. Victor, meanwhile, shook the end of the bone tube he held, and a half-dozen dried brown scorpion husks fell out into the carpeting. His whiter-than-white teeth flashed in his boater-brown face, and he snarled, "Scorpies, scorpies, scorpies!" His eyes gleamed with lust and fury. One of my legs wasn't answering my calls to action, so I crab-walked backwards into the kitchen on the heels of my hands and one leg. Out on the dining section of the balcony, the scorpion shuddered to life and started to grow. First one, and then the others, oriented on the kitchen and started toward me in scuttling bursts of speed, getting larger as they came. Victor howled in glee. The Becketts rose, both naked, lean, and savage-looking, both sporting guns, their eyes empty of everything but a wild sort of bloodlust. I felt my shoulders press against the counter. There was a rattle, and then a broom fell down against me, its handle bouncing off my head and landing on the tile floor beside me. I grabbed at it, my heart pounding somewhere around my throat. A roomful of deadly drug. One evil sorcerer on his home turf, two crazies with guns, one storm of wild magic looking for something to set it into an explosive motion. And half a dozen scorpions, like the one I'd already survived earlier, rapidly growing to movie monster size. Less than a minute on the clock, and no timeouts remaining for the quarterback. All in all, it was looking like a bad evening for the home team. I was so dead. There was no way out of that kitchen, no time to use an explosive evocation in close quarters, and the deadly scorpions would rip me to pieces well before Victor could blow me up with an explosive magic, or one of the blood-maddened Becketts could get their guns working long enough to put a few more bullets in me. My hip was beginning to scream with pain, which I suppose was better than the deadly dull numbness of more serious injuries and shock, but at the moment it was only the least of my worries. I clutched the broom to me, my only pitiful weapon. I didn't even have the mobility to use it. And then something occurred to me. Something so childish that I almost laughed. Instead, I plucked a straw from the broomstick and began a low, steady chant, a bobbing about in the air with the fingers that held the straw. I reached out and took hold of the immense amounts of untapped energy running rampant in the air and drew them into a spell. Politas, I shouted, bringing the chant to a crescendo. Politas! Politas! The broom twitched, it quivered, it jerked upright in my hands, and then it took off across the kitchen floor, its brush waving menacingly to meet the scorpion's advance. The last thing I had expected to use that cleaning spell for, when I had laboriously been forced to learn it, was to use it against a tide of poisonous scorpion monsters, but any port in a storm. The broom swept into them with a ferocious energy and started flicking them across the kitchen, towards the rest of the balcony with a tidy, efficient motions. Each time one of the scorpions would try to dodge around it, the broom would tilt out and catch the beastie before it could, flick it neatly into its back, and continue about its job. I'm pretty sure it got all the dirt on the way, too. When I do a spell, I do it right. Victor screeched in anger when he saw his pets, still too small to carry such mass, being so neatly corralled and ushered off the balcony. The Becketts lifted their guns and opened fire on the broom, while I hunkered down behind the counter. They must have been using revolvers now because they fired smoothly in an ordered rhythm. Bullets smacked into the walls and the counters and the back of the kitchen, but none of them came through the counter that sheltered me. I caught my breath, pressing my hand against the blood on my hip. It hurt like hell. I thought the bullet was stuck somewhere by the bone. I couldn't move my leg. There was a lot of blood, but not so much that I was sitting in a puddle. Out on the balcony, the fire was beginning to catch, spreading over the roof. The entire place was going to come crashing down before much longer. Stop shooting! Stop shooting, damn you! Victor screamed, and the gunfire came to a halt. I risked peeking over the counter. My broom had swept the scorpions off the edge of the balcony and to the floor of the room below. As I watched, Victor caught the broom by its handle and broke it over the balcony railing with a snarl. The straw still held in my fingers broke with a sharp little twang, and I felt the energy fade from the spell. Victor Shadowman snarled. A cute trick, Dresden, he said, but pathetic. There's no way you can survive this. Give up. I'd be willing to let you walk away. The Becketts were reloading. I ducked my head down before they got any funny ideas and hoped they didn't have heavier rounds that could penetrate the counters I hid behind and whatever contents they contained to kill me. Sure, Vic, I replied, keeping my voice as calm as I could. You're known for your mercy and sense of fair play, right? All I have to do is to keep you here until the fire spreads enough to kill you, Victor said. Sure, let's all die together, Vic. Too bad about your inventory down there, though, huh? Victor snarled and pitched another burst of flame into the kitchen. This time it was much easier to cover myself, half-shielded as I was already by the corner of the counters I hid behind. Oh, cute, I said, my voice dripping with scorn. Fire is the simplest thing you can do. All the real wizards learn that in the first couple of weeks and move on up from there. I looked around the kitchen. There had to be something else, some way I could escape, but nothing presented itself. Shut up, Victor snarled. Who's the real wizard here, huh? Who's the one with all the cards? And who's the one bleeding out on the kitchen floor? You're nothing, Dresden, nothing. You're a loser. And do you know why?
Gee, I said, let me think.
He laughed harshly. Because you're an idiot. You're an idealist. Open your eyes, man. You're in the jungle now. It's survival of the fittest, and you've proved yourself unfit. The strong do as they wish, and the weak get trampled. When this is over, I'm going to wipe you off my shoe and keep going like you never existed.
Too late for that, I told him. I was in the mood to tell a white lie. The police know all about you, Vic. I told them myself, and I told the White Council, too. You've never even heard of them, have you, Vic? They're like the Super Friends and the Inquisition, all rolled into one. You'll love them. They'll take you out like yesterday's garbage. God, you really are an ignorant bastard. There was a moment's silence, then.
No, he said. You're lying. You're lying to me, Dresden.
If I'm lying, I'm dying, I told him. Hell, as far as I knew, I was. Oh, and Johnny Marconi, too. I made sure he knew who and where you were.
Son of a bitch, Victor said. You stupid son of a bitch. Who put you up to this, huh? Marconi? Is that why he pulled you off the street?
I had to laugh weakly. A bit of flaming cabinet fell off the upper shelf under the tiles next to me. It was getting hot in there. The fire was spreading. You never figured it out, did you, Vic?
Who? Victor screamed at me. Who was it, damn you? That whore, Linda? Her whore friend, Jennifer?
Strike two, strike three, and the other side gets a chance to steal, I said back. Hell, at least if I could keep him talking, I might keep him in the house long enough to go down with me. And if I could make him mad enough, he might make a mistake.
Stop talking to him, Beckett said. He's not armed. Let's kill him. Get out of here before we all die.
Go ahead, I said in a cheerful tone. Hell, I've got nothing to lose. I'll send up this whole house in a fireball that'll make Hiroshima look like a hibachi. Make my day.
Shut up, Victor shouted. Who is it, Dresden? Who, damn you?
If I gave him Monica, he might still be able to get to her if he got away. There was no sense risking that. So all I said was, go to hell, Vic.
Get the car started, Victor snarled. Go out through the deck doors. The scorpions will kill everything on the first floor.
I heard a motion in the room, someone moving about the doors onto the elevated deck at the back of the house. The fire continued to spread. Smoke rode the air in a thick haze.
I've got to go, Dresden, Victor told me. His voice was gentle, almost a purr. But there's someone I want you to meet first.
I got a sick, twisty little feeling in the pit of my stomach.
Kalshazak,
Victor whispered. Power thrummed. The air shimmered and shone, began to twist and spiral.
Kalshazak,
Victor whispered again, louder, more demanding. I heard something, a warbling hiss that seemed to come from a great distance, rushing closer. The black wizard called the name for the third and final time, his voice rising to a screech.
Kalshazak!
There was a thunder crack in the house, a dull and sulfurous stench, and I craned my neck to see over the counter, risking a glance. Victor stood by the sliding glass doors that led out into the wooden deck. Red-orange flame wreathed the ceiling on that side of the house, and smoke was filling the room below, casting the whole place in a hellish glow. Crouched down on the floor in front of Victor was the toad demon I had banished the night before. I had known that I hadn't killed it. You can't kill demons as such. Only to destroy the physical vessels they create for themselves when they come into the mortal world. If called again, they can create a new vessel without difficulty. I watched in fascination, stunned. I had seen only one person call a demon before, and I had killed my own master shortly after. The thing crouched in front of Victor, its lightning blue eyes whirling shades of scarlet hate, staring up at the black-clad wizard, trembling with the need to tear into him. To rend and destroy the mortal being who had dared summon it forth. Victor's eyes grew wider and more mad, glittering with fevered intensity. Sweat ran down his face, and he tilted his head slowly to one side, as though his vision were skewed along the horizon, and by the motion he could compensate for it. I gave silent thanks that I had closed my third eye when I did. I did not want to see what the thing really looked like, and I did not want to get a good look at the real Victor Selves, either. The demon finally gave a hiss of frustration and turned towards me with a croaking growl. Victor dropped back his head and laughed, his will triumphant over the being he had called from beyond. "There, Dresden, do you see? The strong survive, and the weak are torn to little pieces." He flapped his hand at me and said to the demon, "Kill him." I struggled to my feet, supporting my weight on the counter, to face the demon as it rose and began its slow stalk towards me. "My God, Victor," I said, "I can't get over how clumsy you are." Victor's smile immediately became a snarling sneer once again. I saw fear touch the corners of his eyes, uncertainty even though he was on top. I felt a little smile quirk my lips. I moved my gaze to the demons. "You shouldn't just hand someone else a demon's name," I told him. Then I drew in a breath and shouted out in a voice of command, "Kalshazak!" The demon stopped in his tracks and gave a whistling howl of agony and rage as I called its name and drew my will up to hurl against it. "Kalshazak!" I snarled again. The demon's presence was suddenly there, in my head, raging there, slippery and slimy, wriggling like a venomous tadpole. It was a pressure, a horrible pressure on my temples that made me see stars and threatened to steal enough of my balance to send me falling on the floor. I tried to speak again, but the words stuck in my throat. The demon hissed in anticipation, and the pressure on my head redoubled, trying to force me down, to make me give up the struggle, at which point the demon would be free to act. The lightning blue of its eyes became glaringly bright, painful to look upon. I thought of little Jenny Selves, oddly enough, and of Murphy, lying pale and unconscious on a stretcher in the rain, of Susan crouched next to me, sick and unable to run. I had beaten this frog once. I could do it again. I cried out the demon's name for the third and final time, my throat burning and raw. The word came out garbled and imperfect, and in a sinking moment I feared the worst. But Kalshazak howled again and hurled itself ferociously to the floor, thrashing its limbs about like a poisoned bug, raging and tearing great swathes of the carpet. I sagged myself, and the weariness came over me, threatening to black me out. "What are you doing?" Victor said, his voice rising to a high-pitched shriek. "What are you doing?" He was staring at the demon in horror, backing slowly towards the doors out. "Kill him! I am your master! Kill him! Kill him!" The demon howled in rage, turned its burning glare to me, and then Victor, as though trying to decide who to devour first. Its eyes settled on Victor, who went pale and ran for the doors. "Oh, no, you don't," I muttered, and I uttered the last spell I could manage. One final time, on the last gasps of my power, the winds rose and lifted me from the earth. I hurtled into Victor like an ungainly cannonball, driving him away from the doors, past the demon as it made an awkward lunge at us, and towards the railing of the balcony. We fell in a confused heap at the edge of the balcony that overlooked the room beneath. Full of dark smoke and the red glow of flame, the air had grown almost too hot to breathe. Pain jolted through my hip, more bright and blinding than anything I had ever imagined, and I sucked in a breath. The smoky air burned and made me choke and gasp. I looked up. Fire was spreading everywhere. The demon was crouching between us and the only way out. Over the edge of the balcony, there was only chaos and flame and smoke. Strange, dark smoke that should have been rising, but instead was mostly settling on the floor like London fog. The pain was too great. I simply couldn't move. I couldn't even take enough breath to scream. "Damn you!" Victor screamed. He regained his feet and hauled me up towards his face with berserk strength. "Damn you!" he repeated. "What happened? What did you do?" "The fourth law of magic forbids the binding of any being against its will," I granted out. Pain was something tight around my throat, making me fight to speak the words. "So I stepped in and cut your control over it, and didn't establish any of my own." Victor's eyes widened. "You mean..." "It's free," I confirmed. I glanced at the demon. Looks hungry. What do we do? Victor said. His voice was shaking, and he started shaking me, too. What do we do? We die, I said. Hell, I was going to do that anyway, but at least this way I get to take you out with me. I saw him glancing at the demon, then back to me, eyes terrified and calculating. Work with me, he said. You stopped it before. You can stop it again. We can beat it together and leave. I studied him for a moment. I couldn't kill him with magic. I didn't want to. And it would only have brought a death sentence on my head in any case. But I could stand by and do nothing. And that's exactly what I did. I smiled at him, closed my eyes, and did nothing. Fuck you, then, Dresden, Victor snarled in response to me. It can only eat one of us at a time, and I'm not going to be the one to get eaten today. And he picked me up to hurl me towards the demon. I objected with fragile tenacity. We grappled, fire raged, smoke billowed. The demon came closer, lightning eyes gleaming through the hell-lit gloom. Victor was shorter than me, stockier, better at wrestling, and he hadn't been shot in the hip. He levered me up and almost threw me, but I moved quicker, whipping my right arm at his head and catching him with the flailing free end of Murphy's handcuffs, breaking his motion. He tried to break away, but I held on to him, dragged him in a circle to slam against the guardrail of a balcony, and we toppled over. Desperation gives a man extraordinary resources. I flailed at the balcony railing and caught it at the base, keeping myself from going over into the roiling smoke below. I shot a glance below me and saw the glistening brown hide of one of the scorpions, its stinging tail held up like a mast of a ship cutting through smoke at least 4 feet deep. The room below was filled with angry, clicking, scuttling sounds. Even in a single desperate glance, I saw a couch torn to pieces by a pair of scorpions in less time than it took to take a breath. They loomed over it, their tails waving in the air like flags from the back of golf carts. Hell's bells. Victor had grabbed onto the railing a little above me, and to the left, and he stared at the oncoming demon with a face twisted with hatred. I saw him drawing in a breath and try to plant a foot firmly enough to free one hand to point at the oncoming demon to draw some kind of magical attack or defense. I couldn't allow Victor to get out of this. He was still whole. If he could knock the demon down, he might still slip out. So I had to tell him something that would make him mad enough to try to take my head off. "Hey, Vic," I shouted, "it was your wife. It was Monica that ratted on you." The words hit him like a physical blow. His head whipped around towards me, his face contorted in fury. He started to say something to me, the words of a spell meant to blow me to bits, but the toad demon interrupted him by rearing up its head with an angry hiss and snapping its jaws down over Victor's collarbone and throat. Bone broke with audible snaps, and Victor squealed in pain, his arms and legs shuddering. He tried to push his way down, away from the demon, and the creature's balance wobbled. I gritted my teeth and tried to hold on. A scorpion leapt at me, brown and gleaming, and I drew my legs up out of reach of the pincers, just barely. "Bastard!" Victor cried, struggling uselessly against the demon's jaws. There was blood running down his body, fast and hot. The demon had hit an artery, and it was simply holding on, wavering at the edge of the balcony as Victor struggled and started kicking at my near hand. He hit me once, twice, and my balance wavered, my grip slipping. A quick glance below me showed me another scorpion ready to jump at me, this one closer. "Murphy," I thought, "I should have listened to you." If the scorpions didn't kill me, the demon would. If the demon didn't, the fire was going to kill me. I was going to die. There was a certain peace into thinking that. In knowing that it was all about to be over, I was going to die. It was as simple as that. I had fought as hard as I could, done everything I could think of, and it was over. I found myself, in my final seconds, idly wishing I could have had time to apologize to Murphy, that I could apologize to Jenny Sills for killing her daddy, and that I could apologize to Linda Randall for not figuring out things fast enough and saving her life. Murphy's handcuffs lay tight and cold against my forearm as monsters and demons and black wizards and smoke closed in all around me. I closed my eyes. Murphy's handcuffs. My eyes snapped open. Murphy's handcuffs. Victor swung his foot at my left hand again. I kicked with my legs and hauled with my shoulders to give me a second of lift. I grabbed Victor Sell's pant leg with my left hand. With my right, I flicked the free end of the handcuffs around one of the bars of the guardrail. The ring of metal cycled around its hinge and locked into place. Then I started to fall back down. I hauled hard on Victor's leg. He screamed, a horrible, high-pitched squeal as he started to fall. Kalshazek, finally overbalanced by the added weight and leverage I had added to Victor's struggles, pitched over the balcony guardrail and onto the smoke below, crashing down to the floor, carrying Victor with him. There was a rush of scuttling, clicking sounds, a piercing whistle hiss from the demon. Victor's screams rose to something high-pitched and horrible until he sounded more like an animal, a pig squealing at slaughter, than a man. While I swung from the balcony, my feet several feet above the fray, held suspended in an acutely painful fashion by Murphy's handcuffs, one loop around my wrist, the other locked around the balcony railing, I looked down as my vision started to fade. I saw a sea of brown, gleaming plates of segmented, chitinous armor. I saw the scorpion's stinging tail flashing down over and over again. I saw the lightning eyes of Kalshazak's physical vessel and saw one of them pierced and put out by the flashing sting of one of the scorpions. And I saw Victor Sells, stuck over and over again by stingers the size of ice picks, the wounds foaming with poison. The demon ignored the pinchers and the stingers of the scorpions to begin tearing him apart, his face contorted in final agony of rage and fear. The strong survive, and the weak get eaten. I guess Victor had invested in the wrong kind of strength. I didn't want to watch what was happening below. The fires consuming the ceiling above were rather beautiful, actually. Rolling waves of flame, cherry red, sunset orange. I was too weak to try to get out of this mess, and the entire thing had become far too annoying and painful to even consider anymore. I just watched the flames and waited, and noticed, oddly, that I was simply starving. And no wonder. I hadn't eaten a decent meal in Friday. You notice odd things in the final moments, they say. And then you start seeing things. For instance, I saw Morgan come through the sliding glass doors leading in from the outside deck, the silver sword of the White Council's justice in his hands. I saw one of the scorpions, now the size of a German shepherd, figure out the stairs, scuttle up them, and hurtle at Morgan. I saw Morgan's silver sword slash, snicker-snack, and leave the scorpion in writhing pieces on the floor. Then I saw Morgan, his expression grim, his height making the fire-chewed balcony shudder, come for me. His eyes narrowed when he saw me, and he lifted his sword, leaning far over the balcony railing. The blade flashed bright silver in the firelight as it started to come down. Typical, was my last thought. How perfectly typical, to survive everything the bad guys could do and get taken down by the people whose cause I had been fighting for. I awoke somewhere cool and dark, in tremendous pain, coughing my lungs out. Rain was falling on my face, and it was the greatest feeling I'd ever known. Morgan's face was over mine, and I realized he'd been giving me CPR. You. I coughed and spluttered and spat up, wheezing for breath. Morgan watched me for a moment, then scowled and stood up, eyes flickering around. I managed to get enough wind to speak and said numbly, "You saved me." He grimaced. "Yes." "But why?" He looked at me again, then stooped to pick up his sword and to slip it into the scabbard at his side. "Because I saw what happened in there. I saw you risk your life to stop the Shadowman, without breaking any of the laws. You weren't the killer." I coughed some more and said, "That doesn't mean you had to save me." He turned and blinked at me as though puzzled. "What do you mean?" "You could have let me die." His hard expression never changed, but he said, "You weren't guilty. You're a part of the White Council." His mouth twisted as though the words were fresh lemons. "Technically, I had an obligation to preserve your life. It was my duty." "I wasn't the killer," I said. "No." "So," I wheezed, "that would make me right. And then that would make you..." Morgan scowled. "More than ready to carry out the doom if you cross the line, Dresden. Don't think this has gotten you off the hook as far as I'm concerned.
So, if I remember correctly, as a warden, it is your duty to report on my conduct to the council, isn't it?
His scowl darkened.
So, you're going to have to go to them on Monday and tell them all about what really happened. The whole truth, nothing but the truth.
Yes, he snarled.
It is even possible they will lift the doom.
I started laughing, weakly. You haven't won, Dresden. There are many on the council who know full well you have consorted with powers of darkness. We, at least, will not relax our vigil on you. We will watch you day and night. We will prove you are a danger who must be stopped.
I kept laughing. I fell over on my side. I laughed so much. Morgan arched an eyebrow and simply stared at me.
Are you all right?
Give me about a gallon of Listerine, I choked, and I'll be just fine. Morgan just stared at me, and I laughed harder. He rolled his eyes and growled out something about the police being here any moment to provide medical care. Then he turned and stomped off into the woods, muttering to himself the whole way. The police arrived in time to catch the Becketts trying to leave and arrested them for, of all things, being naked. Later, they were implicated in the Three-Eye drug ring and prosecuted on distribution charges. Just as well for them that they're in the Michigan justice system. I don't think they would have come out of a cell alive if they'd been in Chicago. It wouldn't have been good for Johnny Marconi's business. The Varsity suffered a mysterious fire the night of my visit to it. I heard Marconi didn't have any trouble collecting the insurance money, in spite of all the odd rumors going around. Word hit the street that Marconi had hired Harry Dresden to take out the head of the Three-Eye Gang. One of those rumors that you can't trace back to any one person. I didn't try to deny it. It was a cheap enough price not to have to worry about anyone bombing my car. I was too hospitalized to show up to the meeting of the White Council, but it turned out that they decided to lift the doom of Damocles, which I had always thought a rather pretentious name in any case, from me, due to valorous action above and beyond the call of duty. I don't think Morgan ever forgave me for being a good guy. He had to eat crow in front of the whole council, relentlessly driven by his anal retentive sense of duty and honor. There's no love lost between us, but the guy was honest. I'll give him credit for that. And hell, at least I don't have to look forward to him popping out from nowhere every time I cast a spell. I hope. Murphy was in critical condition for nearly 72 hours, but she pulled through. They gave her a room right down the hall from me, in fact. I sent flowers to her hospital room, along with a surviving ring of her handcuffs. I told her in a note not to ask how the chain between the rings had been so neatly severed. I didn't think she'd buy that someone cut it with a magic sword. The flowers must have helped. The first time she got out of bed was to totter down the hall to my room, throw them in my face, and leave without saying a word. She professed to have no memory of what happened at my office, and maybe she didn't. But in any case, she got the warrant for my arrest rescinded, and a couple of weeks later, when she went back to work, she called me for advice the next day. And she sent a big check to cover my expenses in the murder investigations. I guess that means we're friends again, in a professional sense, but we don't joke anymore. Some wounds don't heal very quickly. The police found the remains of a huge Three-Eye stash in what was left of the lake house, and Victor Sells eventually came up as the bad guy. Monica Sells and her children vanished into witness protection, and I hope they got a better life than they had before. I suppose it couldn't be much worse. Bob eventually came home again, more or less within the 24-hour limit, I suppose. I turned a deaf ear to rumors of a particularly wild party at the University of Chicago, which lasted from Saturday night to Sunday night, and Bob wisely never mentioned it. Date with a Demon was a headliner for the Arcane when it came out the following Monday, and Susan came by my hospital room to give me a copy and to talk to me about it. She seemed greatly amused by the cast that held my hips immobilized until the docs could be sure that there wasn't too much fracturing. The X-ray machine kept fouling up whenever they tried to use it on me, for some reason, and commented that it was a pity I wasn't more mobile. I used the sympathy factor to badger another date out of her, and she didn't seem to mind too much. That time, we were not interrupted by a demon.
and I didn't need any of Bob's love potion or advice, thank you very much. Mac got his Trans Am back. I got the Blue Beetle back. That didn't seem quite equitable, but...